Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. This is a moment when the announcement by the Supreme Court of the United States that the longstanding ruling known as Roe v. Wade is in fact unconstitutional. It has been overturned by a 6-3 majority of the court. And this is, of course, against the backdrop of what has now been not simply threats to the court, indeed, an assassination attempt against one of its serving associate justices, Brett Kavanaugh, but the prospect of a very much wider, violent campaign that is in prospect, as I say, perhaps nationwide, using the pretext of this court ruling, I think it's fair to say, as the justification for a summer of rage. A man who has been studying the people who are making such threats and who it seems are poised now to act on them is my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, I'm proud to say, Kyle Scheidler. He directs our Homeland Security Project as a senior analyst of considerable acclaim because of his rigorous pursuit of the facts, wherever they lead, even if they might be considered to be, well, politically incorrect or impolitic, at least. He's always a great resource for this program. We're delighted to have him with us. Thanks, Kyle, for joining us here at Securing America once again.
Thanks for having me, Frank. It's always a good time.
What are you making of the prospects at the moment that one or more of these groups, you've particularly, I think, called attention to an outfit called Jane's Revenge, may now go very ugly in the wake of this court ruling?
Well, I think, Frank, what we have seen from the radical left since at least 2020 has been a formulation of X or we burn the country. First, it was BLM, defund the police. Then it was Biden's election and no investigation of election integrity. Now it is Roe versus Wade. But it all fits into that formulation, X or we burn the country. And now they have to deliver. So we will see if they are able to do that. Obviously, we've seen elements calling for a night of rage on the day that the announcement was made. That's a Friday. Today, that's good for them, gives them plenty of time to plan over the weekend to conduct whatever they're going to do and plenty of free time to conduct actions. I think we will see some activity tonight. I don't think it will be on the scale of what we saw at the height of the 2020 riots simply because of the larger support networks. They need bail funds. They need money and movement of people. I don't know if that has happened in this case. Partially due to conflicts that we've seen between some of the hardline communist and anarchist groups and disagreements also with some of the more liberal-leaning groups as well. And that's where that big money comes from that pays for the bail funds, the major left-wing foundations, those kinds of things. If they're not on board, often they can't conduct actions of the same size that they would like to. But I think we will see some kind of action. What I think we will definitely see is an uptick in direct actions of the kind that we have seen this group Jane's Revenge perpetrate over the last several weeks. That is direct targeting of crisis pregnancy centers and churches with Molotov cocktails and vandalism. They may escalate as well. Let's hope not, but that's certainly a possibility. I've seen reports on social media that the Department of Homeland Security is speaking to crisis pregnancy centers and churches, warning them of the potential security risk. That's a positive in my book, that they're actually aware of the potentiality for violence here. But I think either way it goes tonight, we will see an uptick in that kind of direct action and violence.
We've been talking with one of our other colleagues, Sam Faddis, about ties between this group Jane's Revenge and the Revolutionary Communist Party of the USA. You mentioned, you know, Marxists in this mix. Is that tie established in your mind, Kyle Scheidler? And what does that tell us about the likelihood that, in fact, not only will this group engage in heightened violence, but that it will enjoy support from beyond that organization itself?
Well, I think the key thing to understand is that when you're talking about the broad Marxist leftist movement worldwide, you're talking about multiple separate lines of effort. The Revolutionary Communist Party is an attempt at a mass line movement. That is to say, they try to recruit lots and lots of people and get them into the streets in order to appear as though they are large and powerful. The violence we're seeing from James Revenge, in my opinion, has an insurrectionary anarchist flavor. That is to say, it's most likely conducted by small cells of individuals, which anarchists typically call affinity groups, who have adopted the name James Revenge in order to conduct actions related to the abortion topic and targeting pro-life centers and churches. They are probably the same kinds of affinity groups that conduct other sorts of direct actions, whether it's radical environmentalists or Antifa style actions. Often you'll see that the sort of affinity groups that are comfortable with violence and are comfortable with direct action conduct those actions on a wide variety of topics, and they just change the name of whatever organization they're operating on behalf of, depending on the target.
In other words, this is a pretext rather than the cause célèbre that animates this group.
Sure, I think they do. I mean, I think they do obviously believe in what they're saying. But as David Horowitz liked to quote an SDS activist as saying, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. And I think that is absolutely what we're seeing here. I mean, if you look at the language that is coming out of some of these groups, it's just repeatedly echoed the same demands, regardless of the topic. You know, we saw during the 2020 summer riots, BLM issued a statement calling for the destruction of the nuclear family. Well, it didn't have anything to do with the topic, but it was part of their demands because their overall goal is a broader revolutionary one. And I think we're seeing the same sort of thing today. I mean, it's worth noting, for example, that this group Ruth sent us, which has conducted some of the demonstrations outside Supreme Court justices' homes and have also called for the targeting of churches, that group was formed as one of these many Stop Trump's Coup groups, which were pushed out in 2020 in order to create a fait accompli over the election. And you'll remember us talking about that back in November and January. So they just changed the topic, but the actual organizers and individuals remain the same. And as I said, it's a multiple lines of efforts across the entire revolution. So you have groups that are responsible for one set of activities, and those are the kinds of activities they conduct. And you have other groups that do other things, but they're all operating together, not necessarily conspiratorially in the sense that they don't necessarily talk to each other, but they all know what their role is and they carry it out.
They have their discrete missions in pursuit of the overall agenda of taking down the country. Kyle, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you about two things that are weighing on me as you speak. One is the point you made in passing there, that these groups get substantial funding from philanthropic organizations that have no problem financing revolutionary, even violent activity, or supporting and enabling it at the very least. And secondly, I want to talk with you about the so-called insurrection that we've been hearing a lot about from the January 6th committee, and what you make of whether they've got something that actually makes that case or not. We'll talk more about that with Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's no secret that domestic terrorists are intent on inflicting violent harm in our country.
It turns out, though, they're not the white supremacists we're incessantly told are the greatest threat. Instead, they are anarchists and Marxists who have seized on the impending Supreme Court ruling on abortion as a pretext to inflict a summer of rage that could make that of 2020 pale by comparison. It remains to be seen whether groups like Jane's Revenge will be joined by unknown numbers of others, including possibly military-aged men who have entered this country illegally since Joe Biden opened our southern border and admitted tens of thousands more from Afghanistan. What we do know now is that if our security agencies remain focused on phony threats conjured up by proponents of critical race theory instead of real ones, our peril will be enormous. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's ruling overturning Roe v. Wade with Kyle Scheidler, the director of the Center for Security Policy's Homeland Security Project and a duty expert on matters involving everything about our homeland security, including the kinds of ideological and other threats to it that we are confronting, quite apart from whatever the pretext of the moment might be. And Kyle's got a very clear eye on what these groups involve and what they aspire to do. Kyle, before the break, we talked just briefly about the fact that the violence that is anticipated to come from groups like Jane's Revenge in the wake of this ruling by the court will be enabled if the model of 2020, the so-called Summer of Love, follows here too, by philanthropic organizations, major foundations of the left that enable bail bonds and in other ways support these kinds of, revolutionary enterprises. How can that possibly be legal? And is anybody trying to make the case that it isn't?
Well, typically what you'll see is that these sort of large left-wing foundations will be funding things that are explicitly legal. It is obviously legal to set up a bail fund to bail people out of jail if you think that the bail system is unfair or racist or something like that, which is the claim that is made. The fact that they dump millions and millions of dollars in the bail fund in the days and weeks before major rioting takes place across the country is certainly interesting from an analytical point of view, but it's not necessarily illegal. And the way this is done is very rarely will these large foundations fund the really risque, scary groups. You know, they don't fund groups with names like Revolutionary Communist Party publicly. What they will do is they will move the money through a fiscal sponsor, which is an approved 501c3 organization, which will then dole out money to groups that have claimed that they're seeking their tax exempt status, but somehow never actually bother to get the paperwork done. So they'll move through something like the Alliance.
Or wouldn't ever qualify for it.
They ought not to. And so they'll funnel the money through something like the Alliance for Global Justice, which will then dole the money out to, you know, a group like the Revolutionary Communist Party through one of their fronts for the explicit purpose of conducting protests and actions. We actually know this was the case for the Revolutionary Communist Party and the George Soros foundations because of some work that was done by Project Veritas. And that money actually was for pro-abortion protests, as a matter of fact, a while back, several years ago. So there is a conveyor belt to move money through these protests. The left realizes that they need these hardcore mass organizations in order to perform the kinds of protests that they want. And they need that because of their claim that, you know, this is democracy, this is what the people want. So they need to see people in the streets in order to justify that claim. And so it's all part of an effort. Everybody sort of understands what the game is, even though they keep their hands relatively clean, I think.
Well, I wish it were the case that everybody understands. I think an awful lot of other Americans are really confused as to how people get away with torching cities across this country and not only get bail, but don't even get prosecuted, especially when juxtaposed to the other topic that I wanted to touch on with you briefly, Kyle, namely this January 6th Select Committee in the United States House of Representatives and its hearings, as they call them, to date, its investigations, its revelations. They seem to be principally about trying to reinforce the, to my way of thinking, wholly implausible narrative that there was this great insurrection mounted on that day in 2021, and that they were about the business of overthrowing the government of the United States and were involved in a serious conspiracy to that end. What's your assessment of the case that they've made so far, this committee, and where the facts actually lie?
Well, I mean, I think it's a pretty good example of where the sources of power are interested in investigating and where they are not interested in investigating. So consider, for example, that you have the FBI now accosting former DOJ officials like Jeffrey Clark, seizing his electronic devices from him over this ridiculous claim. But are they doing that to the organizations that are publishing Jane's Revenge communiques? No, they're not. They would be outraged if you did something like that. That would be a violation of the First Amendment. But somehow it's okay to try to seize the papers and electronic communications of a lawyer speaking to his client when his client is the president of the United States. This is absolutely absurd, and it's offensive, and it's a, I'm going to say, misallocation of Department of Justice resources, but that really doesn't really cover it. It's far more than that.
It's a direct assault on one of the most fundamental principles of our country, it seems to me, which is equal justice under the law and the rule of law. And to the extent that this Justice Department has become so partisan, so political, it really is a travesty, as you say, Kyle. So if the case has not been made by this well, some have called it a kangaroo court or Stalinist show trial even, that there was a real insurrection underway. Has there been any light shed on what seems to me to have been going on, which was a deliberate, intentional prevention of the Capitol from being properly secured on this occasion? And we're learning more. Our colleague Mike Waller at the Center for Security Policy has done some great work on this too, disclosing evidence of collaboration between police units, FBI and others, with these perpetrators of the violence on that occasion. Give us just a quick minute or so on your sense of that that proposition, Nancy Pelosi and the company enabling this sort of direct action.
Sure. Well, if you were going to have a real January 6th commission that was actually interested in getting to the bottom of what's going on here, one of the people you would want to question would be Nancy Pelosi about how the decisions were made to secure the Capitol, why certain things weren't done, who gave the order to Capitol Police that they should open the doors and permit protesters to enter. I would like to know the answer to that question. But they won't even admit that that happened, even though it took place on camera. And a number of other decisions. Who gave the order to release non-lethal munitions when it took place? Whatever happened
against a peaceable crowd, no less.
Whatever happened to the alleged bomber that targeted the RNC and the DNC. What do we know about that? Do we have any leads? Nobody seems interested in that, but we're very interested in reading the emails of Trump's lawyer. And that's where we are with this thing. And it is truly a travesty, as you said. If the Congress changes, maybe they will do some kind of investigation.
I pray to God that'll be the case. Kyle, I'm sorry to cut you off. I don't see it yet either, but we have to pray for it and work towards it, God knows. Thank you for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Kyle Scheid, to come back to us with updates, if you would, in the very near future. Next up, we'll talk about a sunspot and whether it's boresighted on us, and if so, what that might mean, not just for the United States and therefore for all of us. That and more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by another of my distinguished colleagues from the Center for Security Policy, the director of our Infrastructure Security Project. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves. He has served his country in uniform as well as in this really important role, including as the director of our Secure the Grid Coalition that's focused on trying to protect the most critical of our critical infrastructures, namely our electric grid. Tommy Waller, it's good to have you back with us. Welcome, sir.
Frank, thank you for having me on.
I wanted to catch up with you rather urgently because something you and the coalition have been warning about for years, including just recently to the Secretary of Energy's advisory board, seems to now be upon us, namely the possibility of a large solar phenomenon known as a geomagnetic disturbance, foresighted on the Earth. Tell us what the story is at the moment and what the implications might be.
Sure. Yeah. So, Frank, there are a lot of stories at the moment. News headlines. In fact, just yesterday, I printed some out here. I'll read them just because I think it's so impactful. This is from livescience.com. Giant sunspot doubled in size in 24 hours. And it's pointing right at Earth. Okay, so what is that sunspot? That's the visual depiction on the surface of the sun of this electromagnetic energy with the plasma of the sun that darkens just before, many times, it's ejected out into space. And those highly charged particles ejecting out into space are something known as a coronal mass ejection, or CME. And so that's what we're worried about is if that CME were directed at the Earth, it can be extremely problematic.
And problematic in what sense? Is it likely to fry human beings, or is it going to just create aurora borealises or something else?
Yeah, so we'll go to the next headline, Frank, just from 2 days before that. And this is Wired magazine. Here comes the sun to the end, to end civilization. And specifically, it says every so often, our star fires off a plasma bomb in a random direction. Our best hope the next time Earth is in the crosshairs, capacitors. Now, what the author means by capacitors, Frank, are the neutral ground blockers, the sorts of devices that can protect our electric grid, for example, from the types of harmful currents that are generated in the Earth's crust. I'm sure your viewers will recall a week ago, we covered in great detail exactly how the sun can harm us here on Earth, not by, as you said, not by frying our bodies or you know, we won't ever feel the heat of it. We might witness, as you said, aurora borealis. That's the visual depiction, but it has everything to do with how that coronal mass ejection, how it affects the Earth's magnetosphere, and how that then can affect our critical infrastructure,
including devastating the electric grid if it's not properly secured. You mentioned these neutral ground blockers. Talk a little bit about both the nature of the vulnerability, Tommy, to this kind of phenomenon, and the efforts that you've been making, including notably recently with the Secretary of Energy's Advisory Board, to encourage action using some of the resources that have been approved by Congress for infrastructure upgrades.
Right. Yeah. So, Frank, the reality is that it's a 100% chance that Earth will be struck by a coronal mass ejection at some point in the future that is large enough to take down our grid. And in fact, it would probably have global implications, but we know here in North America that we're vulnerable. And this has been thoroughly documented. And that vulnerability has to do with these currents, as we mentioned before, that can be induced into big transformers, but they can be stopped. They can be stopped by something called a neutral ground blocker. The Wired author called it a capacitor. The point is the technology exists. And so this is something, and I printed another headline. It's one that I wrote myself last week about the fact that 1/3 of 1% of the Biden infrastructure bill could actually protect the entire grid from this phenomenon by installing these neutral ground blockers. And Frank, as you mentioned, with the Secretary of Energy Advisory Board, that's exactly what we told them 2 weeks ago.
And how was it received, Tommy? And is there any evidence that the advisory board or the Department of Energy is moving, especially in the face now of this present danger?
So, Frank, you know, I have to credit the Secretary of Energy and her advisory board for taking public comments. Every quarterly meeting, they will receive written comments, and then they will receive verbal comments. You normally get about 3 minutes. They actually gave me close to 6 minutes 2 weeks ago. What's odd, though, Frank, is normally they post the written comments. When we submit our views to them and suggest all these different things that have to do with the security of the grid, within a few days, it normally pops up on the website where you can easily see what you submitted to the Department of Energy. Oddly, Frank, that hasn't happened yet. The video is there, thankfully. There's 6 minutes of me telling them about this problem we just discussed. But the things that I wrote, the things that we published, the facts that show the catastrophic vulnerability aren't yet posted on that site. And I don't know why. And so it makes me a little bit worried.
Yeah, well, I think it should make all of us worried that it suggests that they're not interested in taking the kinds of actions that you're talking about. So, Tommy, if money is not the object, 1/3 of 1% of the billions and billions of dollars that have been allocated to infrastructure upgrades, then what is the problem? What is the impediment to assuring that our electric grid, these high voltage transformers that, as you mentioned, are the backbone of the grid, remain highly vulnerable to this intense energy, perhaps from the sun, perhaps caused by a nuclear detonation from an enemy overhead?
You know, Frank, unfortunately, what we've seen for now decades, the biggest opposition has been the industry itself. And I should remind the viewers that you know, we credit those that keep the lights on with preserving our civilization. We really, the linemen, utility workers out there, I mean, these are heroes. But by and large, the industry itself, its massively powerful lobby, has worked against these common sense security measures for many years. And that's part of what was chronicled in our comments to the Secretary of Energy, was the over decade long history of all of the warnings from credible scientists across the country and national security experts, engineers, including engineers within the Department of Energy itself, alongside
the Blue Ribbon Commission created by Congress for the purpose of making sure that people are clear about the nature of these vulnerabilities and their implications. So, Tommy, if the industry itself is dead set against taking steps like putting these neutral ground blockers in place to protect these enormously expensive transformers, and it's not just that they're expensive. If you have to replace them, you may have to wait years to get one specifically configured to the place in the grid that it has to go. It's hard to reckon why they would be opposed to such practical, near-term, and it seems fairly cost-effective steps.
It is, Frank. It's very hard to understand. It perhaps could be just an admission that they are vulnerable. It's really counterintuitive to see so much pushback from an industry that really could. The money's there. The infrastructure bill is there. We've already paid for it with our tax dollars. It's a fraction of the cost. But it would be an admission for them to say, well, the last 10 years when we said this wasn't a problem, we believe it's a problem now. And so, you know, Frank, what we...
That's not a good enough reason to prevent the actions that will keep people from being killed by the millions. In fact, we mentioned this Blue Ribbon Commission. Tommy, tell us the estimate that its chairman, Dr. William Graham, has given of the kind of loss of life that would be entailed if the grid goes down and stays down for a year or so.
Sure. The Congressional EMP Commission estimated that we'd lose 90% of our population in the first year of a nationwide blackout. Now, how they came up with that number was relatively simple, and I personally think it would be worse, and here's why. They just looked at what could the North American landmass sustain in human population pre-electricity. That was about 30 million people, which is roughly 10% of our current population. And so the difference, Frank, as you well know, is that the 30 million people that lived in North America prior to electricity knew how to live without electricity, and that's not the case now.
It certainly is not. Tommy, before we let you go, there's a new movie that is coming out very shortly. Tell us a little bit more about the movie, how people can get access to it, and the hopes of turning the movie into a movement to protect our grid at long last.
Absolutely. So the film is Grid Down, Power Up, and it chronicles this battle, the truth-telling that we've done for years about the vulnerability of the grid. And as you mentioned, the hopeful thing about it is that there's tools on the back end to help people actually make a difference. That's part of it. You've got to be educated about the threats, and then you've got to get involved in countering those threats.
And how do you do that, Tommy? How do you get access to the film?
So griddownpowerup.com is the website. You can sign up to be notified as soon as it is officially launched, which is going to be in the next 30 days. In fact, just next month, we'll be in Las Vegas with the narrator, Dennis Quaid, for the official launch at Freedom Fest.
Fantastic. Tommy Weller, we're going to stay on top of this. Pray to God that solar spot moves off dead center, boresighted on the Earth, and that we are spared this imminent danger. If we are, we better make sure that it's the last time we are this vulnerable to it. God bless you, my friend, and all the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy, Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Weller. Keep it up. Come back to us with updates as soon as possible. Robert Charles, up next, right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's no secret that domestic terrorists are intent on inflicting violent harm in our country. It turns out, though, they're not the white supremacists we're incessantly told are the greatest threat. Instead, they are anarchists and Marxists who have seized on the impending Supreme Court ruling on abortion as a pretext to inflict a summer of rage that could make that of 2020 pale by comparison. It remains to be seen whether groups like Jane's Revenge will be joined by unknown numbers of others, including possibly military-aged men who have entered this country illegally since Joe Biden opened our southern border and admitted tens of thousands more from Afghanistan. What we do know now is that if our security agencies remain focused on phony threats conjured up by proponents of critical race theory instead of real ones, our peril will be enormous. This is Frank Affney.
Well, it's that time of year, of course, when there is a lot of interest in and action at the Supreme Court of the United States, also known as SCOTUS in Washington. We talked a little bit earlier about the possible violent repercussions of the court's ruling 6-3 on the Dobbs case overturning the longstanding rulings of Roe v. Wade. But we want to talk a bit more about the law and about not only this ruling, but two others that are very consequential. And who better than our guest of choice on matters involving, well, among other things, the judiciary, a man who served in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as an attorney and clerk. His name is Robert Charles. Bobby went on to a variety of other positions of note, including congressional counsel in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, and as an assistant secretary of state for narcotics and law enforcement affairs in the George W. Bush State Department. It's great to have you with us, Bobby. Once again, thank you for joining us. A lot to talk about.
It's always a pleasure, Frank.
Your thoughts right out of the gate about the law with respect to Roe v. Wade. We're going to hear a lot about those who are not only upset about it, but are prepared to engage in violence as a response. But talk about the merits of the case and what the court did in this regard.
Yeah, I think we, you know, Frank, we're living in a, sometimes you don't know it when you're living in such a period. We're living in historically significant times because beyond security on the broader global scale, a case like Roe v. Wade being overturned by Dobbs is really a return, and people should feel very comforted by this. It's a return to the traditional role of the Supreme Court in reading the Constitution, in making sure that the Constitution is properly applied in day-to-day life. And so what this decision does is it returns to the states a right that historically existed at the state level. Doesn't mean that states can't either be pro or anti-abortion. Doesn't mean that states can't press the limits in either direction. But what it does is it essentially says in not so many words that the 10th Amendment really matters, that this notion that rights not given to the federal government are actually reserved to the people and to the states. And if you back up two steps, what it does is it says, what it really does is it says, we will be faithful to the terms and to the spirit and to the intent of the Constitution. And so this decision, which reverses a decision that was a 7-2 decision back in the 1970s, 73, that decision, the Roe decision ultimately was a shockwave to the country because it reversed about 2/3 of the state laws. It left people wondering not just about abortion, but about the whole idea that states had rights. And so what this does is it sends both a narrow and a broad message. The narrow message is that pro-life has a voice. These children that are unborn have a voice, and that there is going to be the option at the state level closest to the people that are affected by the laws at the state level to make that choice and to protect that life if states so choose. And the broader message is that states' rights are not gone, and that in areas of significance to the individual and to those closest to the state government, which is really all of us, these matters will be given back to the states.
Bobby, one other piece of this, which is part of the ferment among those who were very much enamored of Roe v. Wade, is the court's previous holdings that there was actually a constitutional right to abortions under some notion of privacy, I gather. This seems to have been repudiated as well. Do you think correctly so?
Yes. So the notion that a penumbra of privacy, to borrow the court's words, existed either in the 14th Amendment or in some other, the 9th Amendment, somehow could be invented and inserted, was also repudiated. And what they really said is that this decision was not well-reasoned when it was initially written. There are other decisions in the history of the court that have not been well-reasoned or circumstances change. I mean, Dred Scott and, you know, the notion that somehow slavery or separate but equal, you know. In the end, this decision basically takes us back to where the country has historically been, which is that we will not impute a constitutional right that is not reasonably defendable and textually defendable. And so at the end of the day, you know, this is being described as a radical turn by the left, and they're invoking violence, and there's, you know, been a lot of protesting. Reality is, this is really, if you just take a deep breath and you look at this decision in the context of our constitutional, really the pantheon of constitutional cases, this is much more faithful. This Dobbs case is so much more faithful to the history of this country than the history of the judiciary, an independent judiciary in this country, than Roe was. And so, you know, we're really not in a bad place. We're in a place where we should be taking a deep breath and saying thank you that the court is returning to its origins.
In another case, they did as well. The New York State Rifle and Pistol Association case. Clarence Thomas ruled for the court, 6-3 again, was the vote. Talk about the importance of this gun rights decision.
So, of course, Roe was important from a constitutional perspective, and this decision, this New York case, is equally important from a constitutional perspective. What it does is it says that the Second Amendment means what it says. And ultimately what it does is it essentially says that states cannot condition your right to keep and bear arms to the point where they're restricting your ability to protect yourself and your family when you walk out of your house. So what this case tested was the idea that New York, and there are a number of other states, had essentially given almost no concealed carry permits. Indeed, the state Maryland, where I live, says that you have to provide a basis upon which you are going to justify your decision to carry. And as a result, they grant maybe half a dozen permits in a year to a state with millions of people.
Highly restrictive and preventing them from bearing arms in their own defense, as you say. Bobby, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to visit a little bit more about what the implications of this may be, particularly at a moment when the United States Senate and presumably the House seemingly are intent on restricting gun rights. We'll talk about that and more with Robert Charles, former Assistant Secretary of State, right after this. Welcome back. We're continuing a really highly timely and, I think, important conversation with Robert Charles, a former practitioner of national security policy in a number of administrations, but also by training an attorney, a former clerk in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a man who knows his way around the judicial branch as well as the congressional and executive branches. And Bobby, we were talking about the second of three very important court rulings just handed down in the past day or two. And I wanted to get just your further thoughts about the juxtaposition of this affirmation by the Supreme Court on a 6-3 vote margin, no less, about the right to bear arms and be able to go outside of your house bearing arms, no less, in your self-defense, on the one hand, and what the Congress of the United States is in the process of doing that will, it seems, restrict your right to bear arms and otherwise defend yourself. Give us a sense of where this sorts out.
Yeah, we're in an acute moment, an acute angle in terms of the future of the country and how we look at our constitutional rights. On the one hand, the Democrats in Congress and a few Republicans have concluded that the right answer is not to keep people responsible and return a degree of moral compass to the society, but rather to choose as their favorite villain the firearm, and as a result, you have this law that appears to be about to be on the books that does in fact initiate new restrictions on gun ownership. At the same time, the Supreme Court is saying, and the Supreme Court is ultimately Marbury v. Madison, they are the ones that have the right to say what the law really is. And I think this law will be challenged. But they are saying at the exact same time, in the exact same breath, they are saying that the right to keep and bear arms is what the founders said it was. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a musket or a 9mm. You have the right in society to, or a cannon, to protect your family, yourself, and ultimately to create a deterrent, and this was the cornerstone of it, a deterrent against government overreach. And honestly, this decision is so common sense. And I'm in a state right now physically in the state of Maine, and Maine is a constitutional carry state. You can open carry, you can close carry, you don't even need a permit. That happens to be the way America was most of our life. And if you go back to the 1960s, Frank, just one last thing, and that is the implications. So the implications of the Roe case is that more children will have a chance to live and states get the right to protect those lives. The implications of the New York case is that we may return to a period of time in which deterrence of crime on a day-to-day basis goes up. Why? Because when we did not have gun restrictions, when this kind of law, this Supreme Court case, was more the law of the land back in the early 1960s, mid-1960s, early 1970s, between a half and two-thirds of all Americans owned guns, and the overall effect of that was that there was half the amount of gun crime in this country, half the number of shootings and deaths from guns than we have today. So if you think about it for a minute, and there's a lot written about this, the implications of this case are in some ways likely to make the United States safer, to make people, of course, people will feel more empowered and they will think about it. Number one buyers of guns today, the number one high growth purchasers of guns are minorities and women. So think about it. That means that people who were previously worried will say, no, I have a right to protect my kids, myself, my life, my family, my neighborhood. And what happens is, you know, it's deterrence. People, crime doesn't happen where people think they're going to get caught or shot.
Yeah, we're both, I know, big aficionados of the principle of peace through strength. This is applying it at the very local level. From your lips to God's ears about the cumulative effect of this very important piece of judicial opinion, as well as what's going to happen with the Congress. Let me turn to a last case that is particularly noteworthy. You mentioned that you're up in Maine. It involves the state of Maine. And the right to receive state funds for religious education. Walk us through the ruling in this case, Bobby Charles, if you would, please.
Again, Frank, what a wonderful moment, I mean, and an historical moment in American history, because the Supreme Court as constituted now is saying we are going to take the Constitution seriously. That means the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, and all of the amendments, because they come together with those articles that allow us to have Congress and judiciary independent, et cetera. This case involved a family. So in the state of Maine, about half, and I grew up in this state, about half of all the communities in this state or school units, administrative units or districts, do not have a high school. And indeed, the one I grew up, the town I grew up in, did not have a high school. And so what happens is you have to go to some other town to get to high school. So what in this particular case happened is the state was giving vouchers and said, well, you can go to another public high school or you can go to another private or to a private high school, but you cannot go to a private high school that is viewed as having a religious affiliation and potentially teaching and teaching moral values in the form of a religious credo. The Supreme Court took this case, Macon v. Carson, I think, and said Carson versus Macon, I think, right? So and said no, that's not right. The Constitution permits if you as a state are going to give a voucher and allow it to be used in a private school or public school, it can also be used in a school that teaches religious teachings. And you know, the beauty of this, you know, Frank, again, the longer we live, the closer, the more you see that what goes around comes around. When this country was founded, that was where most of the teaching occurred, either from the Bible in a public school or in the church environment or in a church-related environment. So as time passed, the liberals thought, no, we got to drive a wedge here. And they misunderstood and I would say intentionally misinterpreted the First Amendment. The First Amendment says you have the free exercise of your religion, but there cannot be an establishment of religion. And if you think about the origins of that, what it simply meant is we don't want the federal government to become the King of England and tell us that we have to worship under one faith. That's all.
Exactly right. Bobby Charles, you've walked through this brilliantly and very succinctly. We appreciate that very much as we're hard out of time. Thank you for joining us today. As always, my friend, I look forward to a visit with you next week. Look forward to talking to the rest of you, I hope as well, next week. Thank you for participating in this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in protecting the country we love and that equipped with that information and more at securingamerica.tv, you will go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.